Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. Our guests today are Dr. Dahlia Waspy and her partner, Ross Caputi, of the Fallujah Justice Project. So after this song called the Fallujah Song by our friend David Rovix, we'll be right back with Dahlia Waspy and Ross Caputi.
Hear about me when you watch the evening news. So I write this letter for you, my friends, the truth then you may choose. I had a good time at Oxford and the world I did roam. When my studies were finished, then I went back home. All I wanted were good things, land and liberty, and all the sorts of things we learned at the university. I'm not a fan of dictatorships. I'd rather say live and let live. But for those who threaten my family, there's nothing I won't give. I will fight for my country. I'll defend this land. I'll stare at the whites of your soldiers' eyes with this Kalashnikov in my hand. With this Kalashnikov in my hand. When you break down the doors of my neighbors, when you say that might makes right, when you say you're looking for terrorists in their bedrooms late at night, when you torture my brother at gunpoint, on his head a canvas sack, all I can say to you, soldier, is you'd best watch your back. I will fight for my country. I'll defend this land. I'll stare at the whites of your soldiers' eyes with this Kalashnikov in my hand. With this Kalashnikov in my hand. When you come with your tanks on our city streets, and you say these streets are yours, when you say you'll rebuild us with bombers and oil tankers on our shores, when you have gunned down my child in Fallujah, you needn't wonder why. I look at you through the blades of your copter and say it's a good day to die. I will fight for my country. I'll defend this land. I'll stare at the whites of your soldiers' eyes with this Kalashnikov in my hand. With this Kalashnikov in my hand.
Our guests today are Ross Caputi, who is an Iraq War veteran. He was in the Marines, and he participated in the second siege of Fallujah in November of 2004 and has since become an anti-war peace activist, and his partner, Dr. Dalia Wasfi, who is Iraqi American and who has been a longtime peace activist. And she really tells it like it is and hits the empire hard.
Dr. Dalia Wasfi, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. And Ross Caputi, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. So, Ross, I think my first question will be to ask you to explain or tell us about your experience in Fallujah that led you to organizing the Fallujah Justice Project with Dalia.
Okay, well, my head was all over the place at the time while I was in Fallujah. I was really confused, and I was kind of going through a messy transition from going through a mentality of someone who didn't ask a lot of questions and didn't really consider the ethical implications of what I was doing to someone who did ask questions and felt obligated to make sure that I wasn't hurting people. So that, it was, on a personal level, it was a very messy transition, and it wasn't until months and years later that I really started looking into what we did during the second siege of Fallujah. And
you were in the Marines, and your unit was involved in that second siege.
Yeah, I was in the Marine Corps. I was in 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. It was a regular infantry unit. And we were one of the 5 battalions who were part of the second siege of Fallujah. And what our command told us was that, you know, all the civilians had left the city. The only people who remained in the city were 2,000 hardcore terrorists. You know, that's an example. And, you know, I accepted that. I didn't really know otherwise. I hadn't been paying attention to the media at all. I was completely uninformed about the context that set the stage for the second siege of Fallujah. So I kind of just accepted that and rolled along with it. In being trucked into the city, you know, I remember seeing civilians, you know, wandering out in the desert, women and children, you know, with sacks on their back, just, you know, heading for safety. And, you know, I kind of, at that moment, I was like, oh, okay, that's what it meant when they said all the civilians left. They fled for their life out into an inhospitable desert. And there were moments in during the siege where we were kicking doors and going into people's houses, and I see family photos up on the wall, you know, next to, you know, bullet marks and bomb blasts in the wall and stuff like that. And we destroyed this entire city, a city of 300,000 people. We destroyed their homes. We bulldozed entire neighborhoods. We bombed the city into rubble. The entire city was destroyed after. So it really drove the message home for me. It's just incredible how many lives we ruined because of what we did. And this was all in the name of a liberation. Our command told us that we were liberating the city of Fallujah. It was absolutely absurd.
Dalia, Ross and yourself met, and you're married, your partners and the anti-war movement, your partners in life. When Ross was talking about his experience in Fallujah, and he said that he hadn't really been paying attention to the media, well, I was back in the States, and I was paying attention to the media, and I didn't really hear anything about civilians being left over in Fallujah. Of course, we all were hearing the same thing that Ross was being told and his fellow Marines were being told. Do you have a comment on the media and the reports that were happening at the time of the second siege of Fallujah?
What I remember is that it was very comparable to the images that were coming out of Shock and Awe, where we just watched the bombardments and these fireballs and pillars of smoke in the city of Baghdad. I remember there was an image on CNN of basically, I won't know the correct military term, I don't know what was flying through the air, I'll call it missiles, but it was the lights of all these missiles that were aimed at the city of Fallujah, and it lit up the sky. Now that was the mainstream corporate media in America. But I believe that by that time I was following the dispatches of Dar Jamil. And I had wanted to go to Iraq at that time. I had been to visit my family in February and March of 2004, and I was planning to go back as soon as I could because I had such limited time with my family in Basra. So I was planning on going back to Iraq in November 2004, but I could only get as far as Jordan because the Marines had closed the main road from between Amman, Jordan, and Baghdad. So I was actually sitting in Jordan in November 2004 reading Dar Jamil's reports of what might have been going on in the city, because he was in the city in the April 2004 siege, but not in November. And it was a very bizarre contrast between sitting in an internet cafe, you know, people drinking coffee and tea, and we had electricity and water, and I'm reading about like just the decimation of a city that was really within miles of where I was. So, but that was, you're absolutely right. And to this day, they'll recall Fallujah as an epic battle. When this is really, you know, to get the terminology means so much. It was really a massacre that took place that we were responsible for. It was led by the United States and Great Britain.
Ross, I was reading at your website, and I was reading your report on what happened in Fallujah, and you talk about seeing the white phosphorus being used, and I think that was the first time that I know I had ever heard of white phosphorus, and we saw images of people who had, you know, unfortunately had gotten in the way of that in Fallujah. So can you tell my listeners about this and about what you saw?
Yeah, this was on the day before they inserted us into the city, and they were kind of finishing the air campaign against the city, and that we were supposed to be trucked into the city on the tail end of that. And it was an incredible amount of air power that they were dropping on the city, everything from like 500-pound bombs to 2,000-pound bombs. I think I saw cluster bombs because I saw these bombs that kind of they look kind of like fireworks with lots of tiny little flashes and really rapid, like one after another. And I saw the white phosphorus, which is like a giant white fireball shot out of the sky that kind of drifts down in the wind, and it's incredibly inaccurate. It must have covered a radius of like 50 meters, and there's no way to aim it. The wind can take it any which way.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know this at the time, but there were still up to 50,000 civilians living in the city, and there were civilians taking refuge all along the outskirts. So wherever it landed, there was high probability that it could have hurt civilians. Any type of indiscriminate means of warfare is a war crime, and that's absolutely indiscriminate. I mean, there's by definition, there's no way to aim it. It's not a precision weapon. So that was really terrible.
And you also, in your at your website and your report, you list many. You just don't say we did this and it's a war crime. You list the international law that makes it a war crime. Can you tell us some of the war crimes that you witnessed, and has anybody been held accountable for those?
No, there's been no accountability for the U.S. forces involved in either the siege of Fallujah or the second siege of Fallujah. And I actually worked with a law professor when I was at Boston University to put that piece together and to try to correctly describe exactly what was a violation of what. And most of it all falls under the definition of indiscriminate means of warfare. Probably the very first thing that should be mentioned is that all military-age males were not allowed out of the city. Whether there was any evidence of them being part of the resistance or not, anywhere from like a teenager to an old man was forced to stay in the city. So that in itself is very indiscriminate, because we then waged war on the city in a very indiscriminate manner, with indiscriminate bombing, as I just described, and indiscriminate ground methods. Within the first couple days of the ground siege, we started using tactics like reconnaissance by fire, which means if you see a house and you're not sure what's inside, you fire your weapons into it, just to see what's inside. If you hear screaming after, there's probably humans. If you hear nothing, it's probably empty and it's probably safe to go in and search it. That, by definition, is indiscriminate. You don't know what you're firing at.
Yes.
You're firing to find out what you're firing at. We also started bulldozing entire neighborhoods. I remember very distinctly sitting up on a roof and watching a unit to our right flank bulldoze house after house after house, not checking to see if there are civilians inside, you know, taking refuge, trying to sit out the siege. As the siege progressed for the full, you know, 3 weeks that it lasted, we just continuously used more and more indiscriminate means of warfare, putting our safety above the safety of the civilians that might have been remaining in the city.
And that's not allowing any males to leave the city, and, you know, the age, the arbitrary age for a terrorist or an insurgent reminds me of the Obama administration. The Obama administration has said that, you know, any male over 15 in certain areas are considered so-called terrorists unless proven posthumously that they weren't. So, you know, if we drop a Hellfire missile on an area and a male over 15 is killed, then that person is considered a terrorist, unless, you know, somebody wants to prove after the fact that the person wasn't a terrorist.
Yeah.
It's really interesting because I just read from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights that there were 3 civil complaints that were dismissed by Israeli courts about, and there were separate civil and criminal petitions, but the civil petitions regarding the deaths of, I think, a total of 14 people during Operation Calf Sled, which was the Israeli military assault on Gaza in 2009. And these petitions were dismissed because the stance of the court was that this was an official Israeli military operation, and there is no, basically, that you can't, whatever happens. And so this sort of parallel position of the United States and Israel is completely contrary to international humanitarian law, specifically the 4th Geneva Convention protecting civilians in the time of war. I mean, you couldn't get a more open and shut case. I'm not a lawyer, but I watch law shows on TV, and this really seems pretty straightforward. But this new and they cover it up. This whole approach, as they call it, humanitarian.
Right.
This is a humanitarian intervention. This is the latest spin on things, and it's said so many times, but this is so Orwellian. George Orwell was just a few years off with his book 1984. We are full-fledged now.
So, like you brought up, the humanitarian interventions that the Obama administration has been involved in, but it reminds me of, you know, the Bush administration. It seems like their pretense was liberation. And it seems like the Obama administration has gotten away from using that word, but now they kind of hide their war crimes under the label of humanitarian.
Absolutely, and it's unbelievably it's working. He's a lawyer, so it's all I come from a medical profession, so I'm not a big fan of lawyers to begin with.
Uh-huh.
Sitting using the words. And this actually, yeah, has gone. And this is the failure of the so-called peace movement in this country, the mainstream peace movement, the peace industrial complex.
Right.
There was recently an article about a decision made by the leadership of Veterans for Peace to move to impeach Obama over his involvement of U.S. backing of the NATO's so-called intervention in Libya.
And right.
It was, all atrocities and death and destruction aside, he did it without going through Congress. And there was a movement to impeach him, and it was absolutely dropped by the mainstream peace organizations who followed through on demanding impeachment for George W. Bush. So it really exposed the so-called anti-war movement in this country, the mainstream anti-war movement, as really just an anti-Republican Party movement. And there is, now that's not to say that people are not still decrying drones and our continued operations, but there's some sort of, people are trying to take credit for, well, we've stopped the attack on Iran. And I don't understand that line of thinking, because there's now been Yemen's attack, Somalia's attack, Iraq is destroyed, Afghanistan is destroyed, we're droning Pakistan, and we're saying, oh, but look, we stopped, oh, and we're arming insurgents in Syria. But there's really nothing to be proud about, and we should have kept going full steam. Which, frankly, is what you did, and you lost a lot of backers because of it. By maintaining the integrity of the principles of anti-war, but the mainstream movement seems to have been, My only conclusion is that they had connections to the Democratic Party. I don't know why else that would continue. That's my hypothesis. So, but that exposes the failure in this country to really have a definitive movement for a change for the better.
Well, absolutely, and I just read an article on Global Research the other day that the U.S. now has troops in 35 countries in Africa. Who else could get away with that besides Barack Obama? And the establishment anti-war movement, there's not a peep out of the establishment anti-war movement. But I want one of you guys, whichever one wants to answer, to tell my listeners about the Fallujah Justice Project and what you're trying to do with that.
Okay, well, we're doing a number of things. Every year in November, we do Remember Fallujah Week, and we just organize a series of events trying to inform the public about what happened in November 2004, what the consequences of that were, with the rise in birth defects and cancers in Fallujah, and to try to educate people about the type of weapons that were used for the very first time in that siege and now have kind of become very common in the U.S. and the Israeli military today, the thermobaric weapons that very likely use uranium and pollute wherever they're used with radiation. There's a number of books that we're working on. So myself and Farhat Alani are working on a book. Farhat is a French journalist, but both his parents are from Fallujah, and he made a really terrific documentary about the health crisis in Fallujah called Fallujah, A Lost Generation.
Mm-hmm. And the crisis is crisis. That's a mild word for it, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's really incredibly serious. It's one of the worst public health crises in history, worse than in Hiroshima after the atomic bombs. The rates of cancer and birth defects are much higher.
I think that, yeah, if, again, I'm not a lawyer, but it can be, I think the argument can be made that this can be classified as genocide when you're targeting the future generations of a people. You have to prove intent to do so, and that's difficult to do, which is, I think, why the law was written that way. But I would characterize this as genocide.
So, Dalia, I want to ask you this. What, you know, of course we are supposed to, you know, praise Obama because he ended the war in Iraq, and you know, part of the problem is that he got a Nobel Peace Prize, and people think he's anti-war because he called the war in Iraq stupid, even though he said he's not against war. So what, you're Iraqi American, you have family there. What is your sense of where Iraq stands today?
Well, I'm watching from a distance, and which I think is a reflection of the repression that has continued and worsened to this day in Iraq, is that I can't talk politics with my cousins. So out of fear of anybody listening to the conversation and that there would be repercussions for them because of it. But I think, yes, technically there was an official troop withdrawal in 2011, but this does not include the thousands who remain, U.S. Military personnel who remain behind to protect at least the U.S. embassy. And then there are thousands of mercenaries, and by my estimation, it's the CIA administrators operating out of the embassy, and I'm not sure how many they have involving themselves in government affairs and civil affairs in Iraq today. But what we can see now, which is our legacy from the invasion and occupation with the government that came to power during our occupation, is that these unbelievable degrees of repression, including arbitrary detentions, torture, rape, this is ongoing for Iraqi society, and this is what the demonstrations in Iraq are about today. Now, of course, the mainstream media tells us the story that, well, this is a Shia government, and these are Sunni who are upset with that, and so they're rejecting the Shia government. But from all the news that I'm getting on the ground, that this is, they're actually, I mean, and they put the signs in English for Western media that say that we are against sectarianism, we reject the tyranny of this government. We reject Nouri al-Maliki, and there's no sectarianism. This is unity. And also as a result of our invasion, religious groups and their militias that were based in Iran crossed over into Iraq, especially southern Iraq in the earlier years, 2003, 2004, 2005, and became dominant in the south. And what also happened was that under our control of the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Defense, we installed individuals who would orchestrate the death squads in Iraq. And these individuals, like Bayan Jaber, also was from Iran, originally Iraqi, but was from Iran and was actually high-ranking official of the Badr Brigades. So the structure that is in place in Iraq today is absolutely, they call it the second part of the occupation. Iraqis know exactly what's going on, and they are fighting once again to have their, basically to have their sovereignty. So this is the legacy that continues today. Most of the West, as far as I can tell, is turning a blind eye to it. But this is a real liberation movement. You can call this a liberation movement. And meanwhile, the U.S. administration continues to deal arms with the Iraqi government. So it's same old, same old. This is very comparable to the relationship that the United States had with Saddam Hussein during the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And when Nouri al-Maliki no longer satisfies our agenda in the area that we will have to quote unquote liberate Iraq again. So we'll see what happens. But the people, their slogan is no retreat, and they have endured enough and are willing to. I mean, they have bled for their future in the past. There is no hesitancy now, and these. The demonstrations were really spearheaded in Fallujah. Fallujah was a hot point of resistance under the British occupation in the 1930s, during the direct American occupation after shock and awe, and again today. So it's really a remarkable reflection of the resiliency of Fallujah and Iraq in total.
Well, thank you, Dahlia. Dr. Dahlia Wasfi and Ross Caputi, we're running out of time, and again, I'd like to thank you for being on the show, but how can my listeners help your project?
So they can find us at www.thefallujahproject.org, and we work with anyone who's willing to work with us. So if they're willing to help us organize events to raise awareness, to organize film screenings, to organize speaking events, anything to spread the word, that would be a big help.
Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing and for your collaboration. And again, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, that's the soapbox for today. I hope you go to the Justice for Fallujah Project. Check it out. They have a lot of information on the website, and help out if you can. Well, as always, I'd like to thank my engineer and connection to Community Progressive Radio, Don DeBar, my producer, Mikey, my guests, Dahlia Wasfi and Ross Caputi, and as always, especially you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.